Tape 6 of The Inner Art of Meditation. We rejoin the final class in our series with Jack Kornfield.
I'd like to start by talking again a bit, and then we'll do a couple of exercises as we go along here. Give you a sense in this last evening of applying the meditation or connecting the meditation to our life in addition to the ways that we've worked with it already. There's a spirit of integration that's central to Buddhist practice and particularly to this way of Vipassana. There's a teaching that's quite relevant to this point. It's a teaching called the Near Enemies. In the development of meditation, it's said that if one proceeds over time, there will come four divine qualities that get cultivated or nourished in the heart of ourselves, our being. The first is the quality of greater loving kindness. And kindness is really essential for meditation to work. If you're always fighting against yourself, you're not accepting what's here. The second is greater compassion. The third is the divine quality of joy, and particularly joy in the happiness of all beings, of others as well as oneself, sympathetic joy. And the fourth is the quality of profound equilibrium or equanimity or balance. Now, each of these has a near enemy. That is, each has a state that comes and masquerades like it, but is really not the same at all. The near enemy to loving kindness is attachment. You may have noticed it in your life. You love a thing or a person or something, which means you feel one with them. You feel connected. There's this genuine appreciation. And then this other force slips in that doesn't want them to leave or doesn't want them to change or in some way tries to possess them. It really sees them as separate and grasps. The near enemy to compassion is pity. Oh, that poor person, they're suffering as if they were somehow different than us. When real compassion sees someone else's suffering and knows it because of one's own suffering. We both suffer. We're in the soup together. The near enemy to sympathetic joy is the comparing mind. They got more or less or equal to what I do. It's that quality that tries to measure everything. And the most important one for tonight, the near enemy to equanimity is indifference. Is the quality of not caring. I'm fine. I mean, it's all okay. It's all passing anyway. So who cares if I stay married or I get divorced or if I keep the job or I don't? It's sort of the old hippie style, you know. What does it matter anyway? It's all changing. Indifference, as in all of these, in pity and in attachment and so forth, is a force to separate you from the world. Indifference says, I don't care about it. I've got mine, or I'll go my way and forget about everything else. And it's really based on fear. True equanimity, just as true loving kindness is an openness to experience another person as part of yourself, true equanimity is a balance in the midst of life. Instead of a running away or not caring, it's an ability to open to all the changes and find a place of equilibrium, of having a sense of peacefulness in the midst of all these changes. So that what spiritual life asks is not a removal from the world, which we sometimes hear or think, but quite the opposite, something much harder. A going into the very center of our life and finding the peace there. There's a wonderful teacher named Vimala Thakkar in India, who's a woman that worked for a long time in the land reform movement of Gandhi and Vinoba Bhave and rural development. She's a meditation master who was trained and in some ways a Dharma heir to Krishnamurti. And after doing a lot of development work, she went around the world teaching meditation retreats. And I went to her ashram to visit her on a tour where we were talking about spirituality and social responsibility with people in India, Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama, and others for National Public Radio. And I went to interview her because she was back working in the villages. And I said, is that because you found that meditation didn't really work and that you really need to go back and just get into what people's lives are doing? And she was very offended by that. She said, not at all, sir. She said, in fact, it's this way. I am a lover of life, sir. And as a lover of life, I cannot stay out of any area of life. So if I walk by a village and there is dirty water and people are hungry and I know something about cleaning water or how to grow food, how can I but respond to that? Or if I'm in Chicago or Amsterdam or New York and I see people suffering as deeply as in India, suffering from loneliness, suffering from lack of connection with one another or with their own deeper spiritual understanding, how can I but respond to that sorrow in the same way? There's no difference. The Sufis put it this way, praise Allah, but tie your camel to the post. Right? That you want to have a spiritual life, but it needs to be connected to this moment, to this body, to what's here right now. The meaning of this is found in this word bodhisattva, which is central to the Buddhist tradition. The Buddha was a bodhisattva. Anyone who undertakes the spiritual practice becomes a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva, bodhi means liberation or awakened, and sattva is a being who is committed to awakening, committed to use the various circumstances, even if the sun arises in the west instead of the east, even if there's terrible suffering and pain, it doesn't matter. Whatever there is, to use the circumstances of life to develop the infinite capacity for compassion and understanding or wisdom, to use all situations. Now, remember last week I talked about meditation as a deep process of listening? That's part of what allows us to be so. If we sit and open our hearts to feel our fears and our greed and our anger and rage and prejudice and desire and restlessness and our love and joy and all of those things that are in us, because I assure you they're in there. If you look, I promise you, you'll find them. Then, when somebody else touches their fear or their aggression or their sorrow, we'll really understand them. It won't be pity, but it will be a deep understanding. We need to do that to bring compassion to this earth. Somebody has to do it, and it's us. If one is to do good, says William Blake, it must be done in the minute particulars. General good is the plea of the hypocrite, the flatterer, and the scoundrel. If you want to make spiritual practice alive, it's in how you drink your tea. It's in how you drive, whether you cut people off on the road or whether you are as spiritual behind the wheel in some way. And I don't mean that in some idealistic sense, but whether you see that that's a place that you can either be aggressive and harmful, or you can be calm or compassionate. And it's true of every aspect of life. It's how you live with people. And more than anything, it takes a lot of courage to do that. This is from Martin Luther King. We will match your capacity to inflict suffering with our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. We will not hate you, but we cannot, in all good conscience, obey your unjust laws. But we will soon wear you down by our capacity to suffer. And in winning our freedom, we will so appeal to your heart and conscience that we will win your freedom as well. Isn't that amazing? And it rings true, doesn't it, when you hear it? There is a power in us that can make the worst circumstances, and believe me, sooner or later you will face the worst circumstances. Everybody will. The things we most love change or die. Difficulties come. It's part of birth and death. Can we take that and make that into our practice, to make it all a practice? To see this, is to see a kind of strange dichotomy in making it all practice. One is that it is unpossessable. We don't own this body. We barely control our minds and our feelings, just barely. Kind of like a ship out of control, a little bit down through the straits. Maybe we won't crash into the reef or whatever it is. We possess nothing, really, except that we have this capacity to awaken or to love, which is an extraordinary thing to have. We don't even possess that. That is the nature of consciousness. And when we stop struggling or fighting or being lost or deluded, that shines. It shows itself. Now, even though it's selfless, there is nobody, there's no one who owns this. In fact, if the deeper you look in meditation, the more you see that there isn't anybody here at all. There isn't. There's just kind of this dance of light and shadow and form and color and thought with no separation. The separation is made only because we believe in it. And it's an experience that's true. So it's selfless and unpossessable in one way. And impermanent, and all changes. On the other hand, even though that's true, and one might say, well, then what does it matter? People suffer. The earth can be destroyed ecologically, or it can be preserved. We care about the people that are around us in all kinds of ways. And even though it's impermanent, instead of saying, well, it doesn't matter, another response is to say, it's a very short dance. We're only here for a little while. And maybe the best way to live in it is to really honor it and value it and live from one day to another and one moment to another as if it were our last, as if this were the only moment, which it is. That makes the teachings very simple. I remember going to see the Dalai Lama on that trip with my wife and a couple of friends. We went to interview him, and he's really busy. He's the head of state in exile, and he has all these disciples and political problems and so forth. He still saw us. He was still very gracious, and he'd been to our center in Massachusetts. I'd met him a few times. I don't really know him at all. He's a wonderful fellow, really quite extraordinary being. And he said, yes, for social responsibility and spirituality, I'd love to talk to you. So he did. We had this audience at his big temple in Bodh Gaya. And it's not like he sits on a throne, which some gurus do. He ushers you in, and he said, sit down, and he poured us tea, and now how can I help you? He really takes care of you, very gracious. We asked all our questions, and we were about to go. And he said, don't you want to take my picture? And we all had cameras, and we were so excited because it was so terrific to be with him that we kind of forgotten, but we were all loaded down with these cameras. So we said, yes, of course, we just forgot. So we said, I'll tell you what, you give your cameras to my attendant who knows how to work all these Western cameras, and then we can be in the picture together. So we gave our cameras over, and he stood up, and my wife and I were on one side, and these two journalist friends that we traveled with were on the other, and he put his arms around the four of us, and we're all just grinning from ear to ear. It's just great, you know. And so all the pictures are done and smiling. We had it on our refrigerator for about 5 years as a Dalai Lama. And then he grabs my hand. He turned to me and he looked. And I thought he was going to say, how's the teaching going? How's the meditation center? How are the retreats? In a sense, how's business? You know, because we're in the same company, right? Selling the same product, more or less. But he didn't at all. He looked at me and he said, you're so skinny, you should eat more. And it was like, this is the highest tantric teaching. It's not a question of what extraordinary states of mind can you attain, although they do come at times through meditation, and you can learn things from them. But what matters is then when you come back, how do you treat your breath, your body, your feelings, your sexuality, the people you live with, the plants in your neighborhood, the people on the highways, and the whole of the earth? And that's really what meditation is about. Now, to give you a good example, we'll do an eating meditation followed by a walking meditation. So I'm going to pass out these little boxes of raisins. Take just, there aren't one for everyone. Open it and take just 4 or 5 raisins and then pass the box back so that the people behind you can all have some raisins. And don't eat them yet. Okay? Now, I'll speak while you take the raisins. We spend a lot of time in our life eating, buying food, cooking, getting it from the supermarkets or growing it in our garden, storing it away, taking it out, seasoning it, chopping it up, cooking it, serving it on the table, eating with our friends, then washing the dishes, putting all the food away, often 2, 3, 4 times a day. Most of that, for many of us, is done on automatic pilot. Do you know what I'm speaking of? We do it, but we do it pretty unconsciously. Now, if you recall, on the first night, I spoke about how right speech, working with conscious speech, is a part of spiritual life, or non-harming other beings. Now we work with the breath or with sounds. Eating, all this big activity, can be made a meditation. Now, how would you do a meal doing eating meditation? We'll practice. First of all, you take your food, and if you want to do it in a formal way, you kind of slow down. You take your plate of food, and you put it in front of you. Some people like to say a little prayer or blessing. Thanks for the food. Thank you to the sun and the rain and the earth and the people who grew it and Mother Earth and stars and all of that. You can do that if you like. It's wonderful. Thanks to the earthworms that helped and the ants and bees. That's what makes your food possible, you know. Without bees, you could not live. You would die if there were no bees. You would die if there were no earthworms. Your life depends on earthworms. It does. We're all interconnected. So take care of earthworms because they take care of you. So then you're done. You're a blessing, whatever kind you do. You then sit with your plate in front of you for 60 seconds and do nothing. You just sit there and relate to that silence. And maybe you feel hungry. So you finally stop just eating when you're hungry and you feel hunger because the world runs on hunger and desire and you're going to stop and face it for 60 seconds. Is your belly hungry? Your eyes hungry? Is your tongue hungry? What does hunger feel like? Hunger, you experience it. And you make your peace with it. You understand it a bit more. Or maybe other feelings come. You notice those. Look at your food. Then when you're ready, you begin to eat and you do it slowly and mindfully, the same way we'd follow the breath or be aware of other things in the body. Let's practice with the raisins. You hold them out in one hand. First, there's just the seeing. You don't even see raisins. What you see, raisins is the word. Look. Do you see raisins? You see color and shape. Then we put all these words on things. But see, there's certain form, shape, color. To get to that level of experiencing what's here in this moment. Then certain feelings might arise. Maybe you're hungry, so you salivate. You feel that, hunger, salivation. Maybe you hate raisins, so hatred arises. Okay, hate it. And you just be with that. Keep looking. Stay with that. This is food. This comes from the earth. It was plants, grapes. Then it died, right? It was organic. Then it was in the sun for a while, and now we eat it. We're part of the earth. We're animals. Now take your fingers and touch it. You won't feel raisins either. What do you feel? Sticky, soft, certain pressure. And then when you're ready, take a couple in your fingertips and being aware of moving the arm. Raising the arm is a meditation. Slowly raise the arm. Make everything very slow for this time so you can feel it raising. Then consciously opening the mouth, feel that. Placing it on your tongue, what that feels like. Close your mouth, but don't chew yet. Then lower your arm, lowering, lowering. Maybe close your eyes for this bite. Let your eyes be closed. And then begin to chew and taste and swallow quite mindfully. Stay mindful. Be aware when you, if you want to, you can be aware after you've swallowed. See if you can feel it go down your esophagus to your stomach if you really attend to. And whenever you're done, let your eyes open. What did you notice as you ate the raisins? Anyone, please.
Sweetness.
Sweet. Was it very sweet?
Mm-hmm.
Just right. What'd someone else say about it?
Intense.
Very intense. Do you think that we spike these raisins? LSD in the raisins? Do you know why it was so intense? Anybody? Because you were there. That's right. That's what makes something intense. We can go out to restaurants, and there are certainly thousands in the Bay Area. Northern French, Italian, seafood, grilled cuisine of some gourmet type, whatever it is. And you have this fabulous meal, some exotic food, Ethiopian, whatever. Nice conversation, good glass of wine and stuff. At the end of the meal, you're hungry. How come? Because you were so busy talking and looking around, whatever, you didn't really taste it. So the first piece of this is that you get there to taste it. And it really changes your relation to food to be that way. Also, you find that how much you eat changes. Mm-hmm. Did anybody feel that there was a lot to just two raisins? We were going to do a book, The Beverly Hills Vipassana Diet. Where you just, the only one rule is that you really pay attention when you eat. But now, what else did you notice, anybody?
It seemed larger.
It seemed larger. Again, through your attention, it filled your awareness. Someone else.
The sound of everyone chewing.
Sound, right. The room became the whole room salivated. It was like water.
Kind of like rain.
Well, that's interesting because what you start to see in that are what are called the four elements. The whole of Buddhist psychology can be seen in the bite of raisins. For example, earth, air, fire, and water are the four elements in Chinese or Indian or Egyptian or Greek. All of the traditional systems have them. And those aren't just ideas. They're the way we experience through our senses. Earth means hard or soft. So the raisins went from hardness as you chew them to softness. Air is the element of movement or vibration. So they went from being still to movement as you chew them. Fire is the element of temperature. They went from being cool as you chew them. They got warmer with your body. Water is the element of cohesion or fluidity. They were cohesive and then they got more watery. And your whole body, all the physical experience, is just the play of earth, air, fire, and water, plus a color and the sound form vibrations of different kinds. That's all. And then we add names to that. But the more closely you pay attention, it's not the name. It's each moment a changing color, changing sound, changing earth, fire, pressure, patterns. And the more deeply you feel into life, the more you feel it as a stream rather than as something that's solid. The names make it solid, but the direct experience is movement. Now, how many people noticed that the flavor didn't last so long? You chewed it for a while, and then the flavor went away, and you still had to keep chewing. Did anybody notice that? That the last part of the chewing, it wasn't so flavorful? Some people noticed that was so. That's often where I see people's hands reach out and stick a few more raisins in there. They'll chew for a bit, not even ready to swallow yet, and the flavor kind of dies out, and then get a couple more in there. Why do we do that? Because there's the pleasure, the flavor, it's sweet, it's pleasant, and then what comes? Grasping. Let's get more of that. And so we try to get more in a row, get the next hit, even before we've swallowed the last one. So you get to see the whole cycle, again, of Buddhist psychology, of how our life, which has this array of constantly changing pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, pleasant, unpleasant experiences all the time, every day, moment after moment, it's pleasant and it's unpleasant. Our unconscious response is to keep grasping the pleasant and try to fight away and resist the unpleasant, and so we're always at war. We can't really come to rest with things as they are. And here you see that desire arises as soon as it's sweet to keep it going. And then you learn a different thing, which is to notice the sweet and then notice when it goes. And be aware of its absence and be with whatever's next. So you begin to see how you can learn through eating as much as any other meditation. Here's another part of it to do if you want to work with this at home. See what voice it is. You eat your meal, chewing, tasting, feeling the elements, being aware of desire, hunger, lack of it. Really studying what hunger is like and so forth. Then see what voice it is that tells you to stop eating and which one you follow. There will be, for most people, at least a half a dozen voices. Your stomach may speak first. Had enough, comfortable. Then your tongue might say, nah, that stuff over there was real good. Let's have a little more of that. And your eyes will say, yeah, we haven't even tried the dessert over there yet. Then your mind will come in and will say, nah, you're getting too fat. You shouldn't eat that. I have a different opinion. Then your mother will come in and she'll say, you should finish everything on your plate, dear, you know. And you will hear your mother, your mind, your tongue, your belly, your eyes, and a few other people, perhaps, all with opinions about how much or how little you should eat. The point of it is not which of those voices is right. I'm not going to say anything about your mother, right? But rather to begin to listen at the end of a meal so that you make conscious those voices and start to see which ones you follow. The whole art of living wisely depends on our paying attention. Can you understand that as I speak of it? Okay. So that's the eating meditation. Any questions about that?
Can
we
finish our reading?
Yes, please do. And you might experiment. You might take a meal every week even where you eat mindfully, or a snack once a day where you just eat an apple and make it a 15-minute apple meditation. It is extraordinary just to bring consciousness to that. And it really affects your well-being.
But it's so difficult to do it with hot food.
With hot food? You mean because the food gets...
It doesn't stay hot.
Uh-huh. So then you have to note the unpleasant quality of hot food turning cold or impatience. Mm-hmm. Now, all those things here. We used to go out with our begging bowls in the morning and you get food and then you walk 5 miles back to the monastery and share it with the other monks. It'd be an hour later before you'd eat it. Whatever they threw in your bowl, you ate. And then you got to really watch all your opinions about food. You know, oh, this morning I got a mango. How wonderful, you know. And then you have to share it with somebody else. Oh, I don't get to keep my mango. I wish it were hot. Now, here's another way you can work with meditation. This is the walking meditation. And it will give you another sense of the spirit of what it means to live in a meditative way. And I'll just demonstrate it. We won't have time tonight to practice it, really. But you can practice it when you go home. If you do one more meditation after this class, my recommendation is you practice this for 15 minutes or 20 minutes so you get some sense of how it will work for you. What you do is find either in your house or outside that you can walk back and forth that is probably 20 or 30 steps in length, say twice as long as this area. And the first thing you do is you just go to that place and you stand still. You feel your feet on the ground outside in your shoes. You don't need your shoes off. Just feel the contact with the earth. You get settled in your body. You place your hands in front or in back in whatever way is comfortable for you, your sides. And you bring your attention to be here. Now, for the walking, instead of working with the breath, you let go of the breath, and we were doing in and out of the breathing. Here, instead of in and out, we'll do lifting and placing of the foot. So you stand, you feel yourself present, you feel the breeze if you're outside, you smell the smells, you sense your body, and you really get here. And then you direct your attention, as you did with the breath to feel that, you direct your attention to feel your feet on the floor and the energy and sensations in your legs, the pants brushing your legs, the hardness, the stiffness, whatever you feel of having feet and legs. And then you begin to walk mindfully, lifting, placing. You can say softly these words if you like using the mental notes. Lifting, placing. Mostly, what's important is to feel the steps. The words are 5%. To feel the heaviness of your foot change to lightness. Feel the movement in your leg. Feel the lowering and the touching of it and the contact. And it gets stiff and heavy. Lifting, placing. Feeling it. Lifting, placing like Tai Chi or like some dance. It can be graceful. Lifting, placing. You get to the end of 20 steps. You stop, center. You turn around. Lifting, placing. Lifting, placing. Turn the other way, and you go back the other direction. And you walk back and forth, generally a little slower than usual, so you're not on automatic pilot. So you're more present. As you walk, if your mind wanders off and you notice it, just bring it back. If it goes far away, you move all the way to Colorado, open a seed shop, have your business, and decide that you're going to have a party, invite all your old California friends to visit you, and you're planning the menu, and all of a sudden you go, oh. Then you come back. You say, all right, I've been away. You stop. You center yourself again, and then back, lifting, placing. So that you're really here as you take each step. Or if you want to look at something, you stop and look at it. Beware of seeing, appreciating, whatever it is. That's finished. Feel yourself there. Again, you start lifting, placing. Now, one thing about walking back and forth, it's not a nature walk. You're not walking around looking at everything at all. You're just doing it meditatively, walking back and forth and being in your body. You can vary the pace. If you're sleepy or walking slow doesn't work, walk a little quicker, lifting, placing, or just placing, placing, placing. If that's the speed you're walking, whatever speed works to keep you most aware, that's the speed that's the most important. You can experiment what speed will keep you really present. Now, even the most dim-witted or ambitious meditator gets the point pretty quickly in walking, because you're going back and forth, that you're not going anywhere. You get to one end and you turn around and you go the other direction. No matter how hard you're trying to get enlightened, you're not going anywhere. So that you see pretty quickly the point is not to get someplace, but it's to be where you are. Okay? You leave your eyes open to do it and just kind of downcast. Stand up for just a second. Let's do this. Close your eyes gently. Feel your feet on the floor. Spread your feet about a foot apart, shoulder width or so. Now shift your weight slowly onto your left foot. Feel what that's like. Now one leg is stiff and heavy and hard. The other is empty and light. The knee could bend easily. You can even bring your heel off the floor, but not your toes. And then slowly shift your weight back the other way to the other side. Feel what that's like. The stiffness and pressure of one leg. And then take a tiny step forward, just an inch or two with your left foot. Put it down, lifting, placing. That simple. Shift your weight forward onto your left foot. Yeah. Then take a tiny step with your right foot parallel to it. Lifting, placing. That easy. Back to center. Let your eyes open. sit back down. That simple. Just feeling in your body. Not doing it with your eyes closed particularly. We just did that because it helps you to get an initial sense of what I mean by feeling yourself. You do it with your eyes open and you walk back and forth. Questions about walking meditation? Anyone? Please.
Can you be done in such a confined area?
No, it could be 30 or 40 or steps or so. A routine place rather than nature walk. If you do it as a kind of wander around walk, what happens is you get distracted and all kinds of other things generally. However, if you jog or if you run or you do a lot of walking in nature, you can do that meditatively as well. Other questions about walking? Please.
I find that I sort of set up this rhythm. Am I missing the point?
No, it's okay if there's a rhythm. But what's important is to really feel the moment. So you can find a rhythm in the breath or in the walking, and what it will tend to do is make your mind a bit dull. You can establish in the la 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 more than sensing how one breath begins and the next one ends and the difference between them, or in the walking, feeling one step and the contact and then a whole new step being born and dying. The important thing in the meditation is to stay connected with the changing experience. Let the rhythm be background and mostly try to feel a new way each breath or each step as best you can. Yes?
A lot of this reminds me of children in a sense. I mean, when we're walking, it's like learning to walk again.
Yes. It is recapturing some of the new spirit of a child. It is like walking again. Which is not to say that children are wise, enlightened beings. They do live more in the moment, but they also have a lot of greed and fear and misunderstanding. And so it's reclaiming that presentness of children, but with a maturity of wisdom and understanding and compassion. Okay, let me speak a bit further about integration and how you can work with practice in your daily life. And then we'll do at the end a different meditation, a meditation on loving kindness as a way to close. So the spirit, as you can see, is one of integration, of really bringing mindfulness into your speech, into your walking, into eating, into relations with one another. It's also a spirit of simplicity. Like that story from the Dalai Lama, there's a story. I went to see another Tibetan master, Dujum Rinpoche, who's the head of the Nyingma school, one of the four main lamas of all of Tibet. And I talked to him about my practice and so forth. This was in the early years of my teaching. And at one point, I asked for his help. I said, I teach meditation retreats for large groups, 50, 100, 200 people that last 10 days or 2 weeks. And after I do two or three in a row, I get really tired. I get burnt out sometimes, or I get overwhelmed. I don't want to hear another person's suffering or difficulty or problem. I get irritable. It's hard for me. Is there a way that I can practice so that that won't happen? Can I do a tantric practice, surround myself in white lights, sacred mantra, something that will protect me? So he first asked what my precepts were. Did I keep the basic precepts that we talked about in the first week as the basis of spiritual life, of non-harming through care with sexuality and intoxicants and money and non-killing? And I said, I'm pretty good with those. You know, I have my moments, but I keep the five precepts pretty well. So then he asked a lot more about the retreats and the way I practice and teach. And he said, yes, I can help you. I thought, great, you know, he'll give me this visualization to visualize the bodhisattva of infinite power holding a sword that cuts through all of the yucky stuff that I don't want to deal with and brilliant white light, and nothing will ever touch me again, you know, and I'll be invincible or something. And he asked a bunch more questions about the whole way I taught. And then he said, yes, what I recommend for you is this, that you teach shorter retreats and take longer vacations.
Thank you.
The Dharma is very straightforward. If it's something weird, it doesn't feel right, it's esoteric, it's strange, then what it is weird, esoteric, or strange, but it's not the Dharma. The Dharma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, and it's very straightforward. That's very simple. It's not to be idealistic about things, but to relate to them from a deep place of truth and understanding of compassion.
This concludes Side A. Please turn the tape over for Side B.